We're going to open the House Committee on Human Services and Housing on Monday, April 1st, 2013. And we'll open up the public hearing and on House Bill 3301. Regina.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 3301 has no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. It authorizes the owner of a lot in a planned community or unit in condominium to install and use electric vehicle charging stations.
Thank you. Welcome, Representative Barnhart. You're our first time you've been in our committee.
I think it is, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair. And I want to thank the committee very much for holding this hearing today. My name is Phil Barnhart. I'm the state representative from House District 11 in Eugene. And I have a story to tell.
Good.
That I think may be of some interest. And I'll try to keep it very short because I know the committee has a lot of business this afternoon. One of the things that is happening as we work our way through the whole issue of climate change, the issue of reducing our dependence on foreign oil, and a whole variety of other things, is the development of electric vehicles in Oregon. It's one of the governor's priorities, and it's something which is happening at a great pace. You're probably aware of the electric highway that involves electric recharging stations along the road, especially along Interstate 5. The main difference between an electric car in terms of the practical application of it as a transportation method and an internal combustion engine car is refueling. Otherwise, they drive the same way. The pedals are in the same places. If you can drive one, you can drive the other. But electric vehicles, at this time at least, require time to recharge, whereas a gasoline-powered car, you drive to the pump, you have the attendant place the nozzle, and 5 minutes later, you're ready to leave with a full tank. What that means is that the vast majority of people with electric vehicles will need to recharge at home at night over a period of several hours. That's the way it will work. That's the way it works most conveniently. And so my story. I live in Eugene. I have a Tesla electric Model S electric car. It has a range of about 250 miles. It's a beautiful car. If you haven't seen it, go down to the garage and take a look. I've brought some of the connectors with me. This one is called an EMA 1540, which plugs into the outlet that I have at home, which will allow me to get as much as 10 kilowatt hours of electricity an hour into my car. Driving from Eugene to here and home again, I can recharge overnight in about 4.5 to 5 hours, and I'm ready to do again the next day. We also have a condominium in Portland, which we like to visit, and which has a common a parking garage in the basement. And each condo owner also owns a parking space in that garage. I wanted to install an electric plug-in that uses the same plug-in as this one in that garage, so that when I drove to Portland, I could recharge at home in the condominium in Portland overnight, just like I do at home. The condominium association was wonderful. They were great. They were very easy to work with, but it took 9 months to go through the process involved in figuring out how to do this because it was an item of first impression in that situation. And I submit, colleagues, that what we want, if we want to allow and to develop the use of electric vehicles, we want more people to be able to plug in at home overnight so that they can use our electric vehicles instead of internal combustion engine vehicles to do their commutes around town, to do short commutes to other nearby cities, and so forth. And in order to do that, we need a system in place that allows people who live in multifamily housing to do that. This bill, House Bill 3301, is essentially a takeoff on the bill on the law in California, which was called Senate Bill 880, from several years ago, and it looks like it passed in 2012. So you can look it up if you want to. What this bill does is it it sets up a system whereby an owner of a condominium or an owner in a development like Sun River could install at their own expense using authorized, licensed installers a system for recharging their electric vehicle. For me, all it is a plug-in with, for 220 volts, 50 amp plug-in. For other people, it involves more more machinery. It sets forth actually in two different places because there are two different laws, believe it or not, that apply to Sun River and to the condominium in Portland. So we have to repeat the same language twice. And it sets up a system whereby an owner can do that at the owner's expense and with agreement with the owner's association with some limitations. The owner's association under this statute cannot prevent an owner from making the installation. They can require that the owner do things that are reasonable in order to accommodate the other owners, the association, and so forth. And I'd be happy to answer questions about that. And it does require that unless there's a, there are questions that need to be answered, that the approval come within 60 days of an application. Once this system gets underway and it becomes better understood, that's a very reasonable amount of time. The condo association, the homeowners association for our condominium in Portland took, I think I said it took 9 months or so. It took a long time. But they nobody in Oregon, so far as we know, had actually worked on this stuff before, and it took a long time to figure it out. We hope to make it shorter, easier, and encourage the use of electric vehicles for those who live full-time in multifamily housing in Oregon. Now, the California law also, I think, applied to apartments. This bill does not do that. It doesn't apply to rentals. It only applies to where the person who wants to install the electric charger has an ownership interest. My belief was we should be cautious, go slowly, be careful, make sure we get it done correctly. I think this bill does that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions? Representative Gomberg.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, thank you for bringing this forward. I note in the bill that it says that that the charging station would be in a parking area under the exclusive use of the owner of the vehicle, and that the electricity from that space and that charging station would be billed directly to the owner of the vehicle. Is that correct?
Well, I think would be responsible for their cost. I don't know that it describes specifically. If I may, Madam Chair, Representative Gomberg, if you look on page 4, line 3, the owner of the charging station is responsible for all costs associated with installation and use of the charging station, including the cost of electricity associated with the charging station, and then several other items. I think the point of that is that rather than prescribe a precise way in which this is to be done, let the owner and the homeowners association figure out for themselves what the best way is to get that to for the owner to account for those costs. In my case, I'm paying the homeowners association directly because the simplest way for me to get power was to take it off the house power, and the simple way to do that was to install an internal meter to allow them to know how much power I was using. In other situations, the simplest way may very well be to install a separate meter read by the power company's meter reader and bill directly to the owner. But I think that depends on the situation, and the bill doesn't specify.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, you got yours done, but it took a long time. So you think that an authorizing bill would speed the process up? We can do it now. You just want to speed it up.
Madam Chair and Representative Gilliam, I think the bill does more than that. The Homeowners Association did not have to agree that I could install my plug-in for my car. They did agree to it, but they didn't have to. This bill says they have to. So long as I'm willing to pay for it, and so long as I'm acting reasonably. It also, the very last line of the bill says, essentially contemplates the possibility of an enforcement action on either part to enforce the provisions of the statute.
May I follow up, Madam
Chair?
Follow up,
yes.
Thank you. Thank you for that clarification. That's helpful. How do we, on public property, we have a number of vehicles in the parking garage, and I'm sure other agencies as well. How do we monitor or meter those now at the Capitol or at other public places?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Gilliam, what I can tell you about that is that when I drive to the Capitol in the morning, I plug in using a plug-in because we don't have nice big 220-volt connectors downstairs. We have the standard ones like the ones that your computers are plugged into called the NEMA 515. And it looks like the plug-in that I use looks just like those plug-ins, and I plug it in down there. I made an agreement. Actually, the building administrator wrote a rule that says he would charge so many dollars per day, so many dollars per month for the use of the electrical plug-in. It is not metered. I told him what I thought I could draw off of that little power supply, and he wrote the rule so that the legislature is reimbursed for the cost of that power.
Well, Madam Chair, the last thing I want is the chair of revenue to be out of juice. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Whitfitt.
Representative Whitfitt.
Thank you. What do you estimate the cost of installation to be, and what is a monthly charge for someone like yourself who's traveling from Eugene up here every day to charge?
Madam Chair, Representative Whitfitt, there's a limit on how much a small plug-in can provide. One of the big problems with this set of issues is that a car with any significant range takes between 23 kilowatt hours and 85 kilowatt hours of electricity to completely fill it up. The small circuits that we have in the basement, the standard circuits that run the computer just fine, will supply somewhere between 1 and 2 kilowatt hours per hour of electricity. And therefore, the limiting factor is the amount of time you're plugged in. So it doesn't matter what kind of car you have or how much it could draw from a system. The maximum it can draw from that kind of a system is a very small charge. So that's how the administrator calculated how much he was going to charge per day, because you can't get much more than that much out of it.
Follow-up?
I was just wondering, in terms of your bill, when you have that plug-in, what are you going to pay? What do you pay?
Oh, well, I misunderstood the question. Representative Whitfitt, that the agreement that I have with the Condominium Association is that they actually installed a meter. And my agreement with them says that I will pay them based on the electric rate charged to them by PGE for electricity.
Yeah. I'm just trying to establish, what does it cost to run your car?
Oh,
each month.
Sorry,
Madam Chair. Could have made that simpler.
In Eugene, I can buy power for about 9 cents a kilowatt hour, including delivery charge. In Portland, it's somewhere between 10 and 12 cents. I'm not certain exactly. Here, it's about a dime. The car takes about 45 kilowatt hours to drive between here, a round trip between Eugene and here, and back again. So that's about $4.50 per trip, or slightly more than the cost of a gallon of gasoline.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome. Wraps up with Pope.
And see, Madam Chair, if I could add an additional comment. I've learned, remember, I'm a psychologist, not an electrician. I have learned a lot about electric vehicles, being an early adopter in the process of doing this. Part of the point of this bill is to make it simpler so other people don't have to know as much as I've learned about how to manage them.
Representative Gomber.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of other questions, Representative. I'm a former Condominium Association president. And
wrong guy to be on this committee.
Oh, my. I'm trying to get a clear picture of the bill references the owner of the charging station, and I'm trying to get a clear picture of installing private property in the common areas of a condominium complex. Could you help clarify
sure.
that for us?
Absolutely. Madam Chair, Representative Gomberg, in my case, the parking space where I park my car belongs to me, along with the condominium upstairs. Other places have a different rule. The parking may belong to the association, and the person is assigned a space based on what's convenient. In that case, I think the simplest thing to do would be to assign that person a space that's somewhere near the electrical room, and so the conduit is short. In my case, there was no way to do it without running the conduit through the common area, and we ran it over the ceiling of the parking garage through the common area onto a pillar, which is next to my parking space. The pillar is also a common area, but the plug-in itself and the conduit belongs to me. And that was the agreement that I made with the condominium association. They put a number of provisos in there, including that it is at my expense that the installation was done, any damage to the common area, and the cost of removal when we move. So all that's kind of tied in. They're only. Cost really was a decision to forbear to allow me to actually use the common area space to do that, but we did it in a way that did not impinge on anybody else's use of the space. And I think that this bill doesn't require anything different than that. I think it allows the Homeowners Association, Condominium Association Board to require that that this be done in a way that does not impinge on anyone else's use of the common space.
We have two other people who want to testify on this bill, and we may have more questions, and feel free to ask them. So go ahead, gentlemen. Thank you, Representative.
Just for the representative.
Sure.
Thank you. Representative, I understand what you're doing, and I support it, and I don't want to make you a friend because we're on a bill together, but it's not a tax bill. I've worked the last four sessions, I think, good representative, on homeowner association changes.
Yes.
And there's a process to go through that. The realtors have a board because there's a lot of unforeseen consequences when you're addressing changes in homeowner associations. Two-thirds of our homes now are part of homeowners associations. And my question to you, good representatives, you know, why we want to introduce this separate, because we've got a bill in work now in the building that's a bunch of changes to homeowner associations that they do every year, every 2 years, and they go through this work group. It's a long process. And again, you mentioned some possibilities. I worry about unforeseen consequences and how Sun River is going to apply to them versus someone at the coast, because you got to put different ones in there for the mildew and all that stuff, and sorry, the mildew, the dampness and things like
mildew
that.
Mildew works.
Mildew. So that's the only thing concern I would have is why we're going to do this separate and not go through that process that we have in place for all homeowner association changes. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, woman, members of the committee, my name is Barry Woods. I am a business operations manager for a company called Clipper Creek, based in California. I cover their Northwest territory. I live in the Portland area. We provide level one and level two charging stations for a variety of applications. So I thought I would join Representative Barnhart in providing a little bit of industry perspective after reviewing this bill. I'm also on the board with Drive Oregon and on the board of a group called Plug in America, which has been very active as an electric vehicle consumer advocacy group. But the hat that I'm wearing today is the industry hat. And I would say that we are Clipper Creek. We're very supportive of bills designed to protect the rights of electric vehicle owners to provide charging. for obvious reasons. But I think in this instance, the industry in particular views the residential charging market as a really critical element of the infrastructure. That is going to be where most people, and I've actually driven a Leaf myself now for about 15,000 miles, 90%+ of the time, people are going to be using their residences, whether it's a separate home or some form of a condo or a townhouse. And so I think it's really critical that they be allowed the right to utilize it in a reasonable manner, in a way that doesn't impact the usage of other folks, and that they're accountable for the costs. I think that there are, in terms of the industry, certainly ways to meter, you know, and account for the electrical usage. So I think that those are technological issues that can be resolved. But the idea here, I think, of being proactive and following in the footsteps of California as well as Hawaii, which also passed, I think, a similar type of legislation, fits well with the state of Oregon's generalized policy in favor of regulatory streamlining to facilitate the deployment of this technology. It fits with, I think, our leadership role nationally, that I think if you were to take an assessment of how the rest of the country views the Northwest in this area, I think you would find that they, in particular, would focus on Oregon as having established a model in a variety of areas, most noticeably in the regulatory streamlining area, of which I think this is a subpart. So I think I would urge you to look very, very seriously at this bill as an important foundation to continue to facilitate what's going to turn out to be, I think, the most common type of charging, which is the residential form of charging, just in a different application. I appreciate your time.
So I would ask maybe either one of you. So is this legislation modeled on any legislation from another state?
Madam Chair, yes. This is almost directly from Senate Bill 880 in California that was approved on Leap Day 2012.
Okay. Terrific. Thank you.
I just noticed that. and to get to the question or the comment from Representative Wisnant, if I could, generally speaking, I would agree, but I think that this issue was thoroughly vetted in California, and the kinds of things that are required in this bill for the homeowner are precisely the things that Homeowners Association required me to do in Portland, including the insurance requirements and installation by a professional electrician and all of those kinds of things. So I think we're pretty well covered on the concerns that a condominium or homeowners association might have.
Thank you, Representative. Yes,
just one quick question. Thank you, Madam Chair. What would be reasonable restrictions, aside from the things that are already listed under D?
Well, if I could, Madam Chair, Representative Kenny Geyer, the point of a bill like this is not to spell out all of the potential possible things that might, because every building is different. Every situation is different, and I think you might want to talk to those who are experts in installation, for example. I would say, it seems obvious to me that if I were to try to run my condo in a way that would block other people from using the car park, that would be an unreasonable restriction. It would probably be unreasonable for the Homeowners Association to tell me that I couldn't, assuming I did it in the correct manner, construct a conduit on the ceiling where, after all, no one's walking, if it could be done in a way that doesn't interfere with other installations. One of the beauties of a bill like this, I think, is that it doesn't attempt to spell out all the possible circumstances. It leaves it up to the Homeowners Association, the owner, and the professional electrician, a licensed electrician, to figure out how to do it.
Thank you.
And of course, the power company.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Wright.
Thank you, Madam Chair, representatives of the committee. My name is Christopher Wright. I am president of MPD Systems, electrical contractor in Portland. and we install level one, level two, and direct charge chargers for electric vehicles. We have installed over 100, hundreds of residential chargers and dozens of commercial chargers. I am here to give my experience basically as an installer. We work in 20 to 30 high-rise condominium complexes in Portland and downtown, and some of the experience that I have that this bill represents is you find that the condominium homeowners associations want these installs. They want the people who live there. The people who live there are on the board, but they want to be able to use green vehicles, electric vehicles. Most of them are very LEED conscientious. They want they're upgrading their buildings constantly to meet LEED goals, as far as LEED platinum, LEED gold, etc., saving energy. So what I find is that it's cost prohibitive sometimes for a condominium owner who lives on the 20th floor, whose power is usually near that 20th floor, maybe on the 18th floor for their main panel, to get power out of that system down to the basement where they park their car. It's not that the homeowner association doesn't want to participate in this. It's what I see is that this sets the table for reasonable people to come to an agreement on how that is to be handled and where they can get their power from, whether it's house power or whether it is a separate service for that particular situation, without having to go to the expense of means that may not be practical or even feasible to go to the 20th floor to gain power. And that's why I support this bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Wright. Any questions? Representative Gillen.
Madam Chair, I'm just wondering, given Representative Barnhart's comment about the bill in California, if we have time to explore other bills that he agrees with or doesn't agree with that have come out of California.
I think definitely we should do that. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you for the
that.
Suggestion. Any other questions or comments? All right. Thank you very much for coming today. And colleagues, I would like us to follow up on this. So if you know of anybody, of any homeowner associations who might be concerned about this, have them contact the committee, and perhaps we can need another hearing. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3301, and we'll open up the open up the work session on House Bill 2850. Regina.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2850 has a revenue statement and a minimal fiscal impact. It raises the percentage of the federal earned income tax credit allowable as credit against the Oregon personal income tax in each of four consecutive tax years. It first applies to tax year beginning on or after January 1, 2013.
Great. Thank you. So, committee, we heard this in March 13th. And
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I move House Bill 2550 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
2850.
Is that what I just said?
You said 2550.
Correction, 2850. To the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Revenue with prior reference.
Representative Olson moves House Bill 2850 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that it be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Any discussion? All right.
I have a quick comment, if I might.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to quickly say that I support the bill, and I hope that the fraud that we've heard about associated with the bill will be of concern to those moving forward.
Did we hear fraud on this bill? I think maybe you're thinking of another piece of legislation, Representative.
I don't think I am, Madam Chair. I support the bill, but there's been a number of concerns expressed about fraud in the larger program. And I just want to be sure that that's on the record and that those moving the bill forward, whether it's Ways and Means or in the Senate, make that a concern and a priority as well.
Thank you. That is duly noted, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any further discussion? Then, Debbie, would you call the roll, please?
Lieutenant Gallegos.
Yes.
Lieutenant Copiar.
Who?
Copiar.
Excuse?
Representative Gilliam.
Aye.
Representative Kenny Guyer.
Aye.
Representative Woodman.
Aye.
Representative Whitson.
No.
Vice Chair Gomber.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Chair Flamay.
Aye. Having received the required number of votes, the motion passes. And, pardon? Oh, it goes to revenue. Thank you. Okay. So we will close the work session on House Bill 2850 and open up the work session on House Bill 2980.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2980 has a revenue statement that was issued, and on the Dash 5 amendment that you will find in your packets, there was a fiscal statement issued. It has a subsequent referral to tax credits. It extends the sunset on tax credits related to farm worker housing ownership, operation and lending for construction or rehabilitative purposes to 2021. It modifies language referencing farm worker housing to agriculture workforce or agriculture worker. It changes the name of farm worker housing facilitation team to agriculture workforce housing facilitation team. And you'll notice on your Dash 5 amendment, it's my understanding that it removes the lender's credit and it corrects some drafting errors.
Okay, so is there someone here who would like to speak to the amendment? Great.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Doug Riggs on behalf of the Oregon Opportunity Network, and we very much appreciate you holding a work session today. What you see in front of you is the Dash 5 amendments. Look like they would be easy to put together, but actually took about 3.5 weeks of effort since the last hearing. The reason for the delay was we went into a detailed discussion of the proper mechanism to sell the credits and whether or not we ought to pursue an auction or not pursue an auction. At the end of the day, all were in agreement that an auction did not make sense given the nature of the timing both for on-farm and for community-based housing. So what you have in front of you is a Dash 5 amendment, which, as the committee administrator did outline, does two very simple things. Number one, it eliminates the extension of the lender's credit, which is a seldom used tax credit, so it won't be a huge savings for the state, but they can claim that they eliminated one credit. So that's a box you can check off. And the second thing was that it corrects a technical error that in the drafting of the initial bill, somehow the word facilitation team, farm worker facilitation team, was inadvertently changed to rehabilitation team. So we're recorrecting that and putting it back as a farm worker housing, agricultural workforce housing facilitation team. And those are the two changes. But other than that, I think everyone's in agreement. I have Peter Hanley and Ian Tolleson here to answer any other questions, but I think we're all in agreement that it's a good bill, should pass.
Two questions about this. Do you want to say anything, gentlemen, about the amendment or the bill?
Good bill, should pass.
I like hearing that. Okay, thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
And
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I move we adopt the Dash 5 amendments dated 4-1-13 into House Bill 2980.
Representative Olson moves to adopt the Dash 5 amendments to dated 4-1-13 to House Bill 2980. Any discussion?
And Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2980 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
I guess we need to take a vote on the amendment first. If there's no objection, all right, then that the amendment is adopted.
Okay, and I move House Bill 2980 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference.
Representative Olson moves House Bill 2980 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that it be referred to the Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference. Any discussion? All right, seeing none. Yes, Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to say, on behalf of the farm workers and the friends of farm workers in my district, thank you for bringing this forward. And I urge our colleagues on the tax credit side, for the tax credit committee to move this forward. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Representative. Any other comments, questions? Terrific. So the clerk will please call the roll.
Representative Gallegos?
Yes.
Representative
Cochran? Excused.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Kinney-Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Wisnin?
Aye.
Representative Goodson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bomber?
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Tomei?
Aye. The motion passes, and the bill is sent as amended to the Committee on Tax Credits. Thank you, Committee. Good job. I think we may have to take a... okay, we're ready. Colleagues, we're going to open up an informational hearing on HCR 6.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Concurrent Resolution 6 has no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. It reaffirms a woman's right to make reproductive decisions.
Thank you. With that, we have Laura Tyrrell Patton and Michelle Stranger Hunter.
Chair Tomei and members of the House Committee on Human Services and Housing, thank you so much for your time. My name is Laura Tyrrell Patton. I'm the Executive Director of Planned Parenthood Advocates of Oregon. Planned Parenthood Advocates of Oregon is proud to bring you this resolution in partnership with NARAL Pro-Choice Oregon today. Planned Parenthood Advocates of Oregon is the statewide policy voice for Planned Parenthood's 15 health centers across the state and the 84,813 patients we serve annually. Planned Parenthood Advocates defends and promotes Planned Parenthood mission by advocating for public policy that will enhance and protect women's health and engaging and motivating the public. In 2013, the 40th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, we urge your support of House Concurrent Resolution 6 to reaffirm a woman's ability to make reproductive health decisions. As we outline here, study after study has shown that increased access to safe legal abortion is linked to better physical and mental health, decreased levels of poverty and abuse, and improved economic outcomes for both the woman and society as a whole. Abortion is safe. It is one of the most commonly performed clinical procedures, and fewer than 0.3% of women undergoing legal abortion procedures sustains a serious complication. In fact, the risk of death associated with childbirth is 10 times higher than it is associated with abortion. Since Roe v. Wade, women have obtained abortion earlier in pregnancy, with health risks to them are at their lowest. In 1973, only 36% of abortion services were performed at or before 8 weeks of pregnancy. Today, 63% take place within the first 8 weeks. When there's access to abortions, families are healthier. It is safe. If safe legal abortions were not available, more women would experience unwanted childbearing, and unwanted childbearing affects the entire family. Families with unwanted births suffer from higher levels of depression and child abuse. And when there's access to abortion, children are healthier. Because of Roe v. Wade, cohorts born after 1973 are less likely than those born before 1973 to be in single-parent households, to live in poverty, and receive welfare. They also experience lower infant mortality rates. Meanwhile, states that restrict access to abortion typically spend far less on money per child on a range of services such as foster care, education, welfare, and the adoption of children who have physical and mental disabilities. And when there's access to abortion, women are healthier. In states that restrict access to abortion, women suffer from lower levels of education and higher levels of poverty, as well as form a lower ratio of female to male earnings. These states also have a lower percentage of women in the legislature and fewer mandates requiring insurance providers to cover minimum hospital stays after childbirth. For these reasons and a host of others, it is vital to women's health and well-being that abortion remain a safe and legal medical procedure for a woman to consider if she needs it. Please vote yes on HCR 6.
Thank you.
Representative Tomei and members of the committee, thank you. I am Michelle Stranger Hunter. I'm the Executive Director of NARAL Pro-Choice Oregon and the Oregon Foundation for Reproductive Health. We have been in existence since 1977. I've been in existence in this work since 1970, and I think I'm here today representing those who remember. I began working in women's health 3 years before the Supreme Court decided Roe v. Wade. I was a problem pregnancy counselor in Massachusetts where abortions were not legal except in very limited circumstances. We counsel women on her options of continuing her pregnancy, adoption, or accessing safe legal abortion. Only if she wanted to access an abortion procedure, it meant helping her get to another state. It was the only way for a woman to access safe legal abortion care. And a woman had to have enough resources to be able to get herself hundreds of miles away and find accommodations where she could recover from the procedure safely. A woman was not legally allowed to make her own reproductive health care decisions, no matter what her circumstances were. Out of desperation, women who needed to end a pregnancy often turned to back alley butchers and incompetent hacks operating out of disgusting conditions. These women suffered unsafe, medically incompetent abortions, leaving far too many women dead, sterile, or severely injured. A coat hanger was the medical care that some of these women got. And what I'm saying is not scare tactics or hyperbole. I live this and saw too many women die. Before Roe, an estimated 1.2 million women per year were forced to resort to illegal abortions, and as many as 5,000 women died from those illegal abortions each year. In 1965 alone, 17% of all deaths were due to pregnancy and childbirth were caused by an illegal abortion. This tragedy is not just a thing of the past. Right now, across the world, 13% of all maternal deaths worldwide are due to unsafe abortion. The ability for women to make their own health care decisions and access contraception and safe legal abortion literally saves lives and has immeasurably improved the lives and health of millions upon millions of women. HCR 6 recognizes this fact and makes a resounding statement to the women of Oregon that their government fully and truly supports and protects their health, their privacy, and their liberty. On behalf of all the women who suffered and died and are suffering and dying because they cannot access the contraception or abortion care they need, please support HCR 6. Please ensure that Oregon women can make their own health care decisions in consultation with her physician and her faith. We do not know a woman's circumstances. No one else walks in her shoes. By supporting HCR 6, you're supporting a woman's ability to make important personal decisions based on what is best for her circumstances and ensures that special interests cannot impose their beliefs on women in need. And women will have access to safe medical care. Thank you so very much for your consideration.
Thank you both for coming to testify today.
Thank you.
Could I call up Liberty Pike and Kaylee Mosher?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Liberty Pike, and I am here as a concerned citizen to speak in opposition to HCR 6. Oregon is currently the only state in America that has zero restrictions on abortion and is thus extreme with regards to its support of abortion. Therefore, an additional resolution proclaiming its support of abortion is unnecessary and excessive. What truly is necessary in Oregon is a restriction on partial birth abortion that would enable state prosecutors to enforce the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act of 2003. I am currently pregnant with a daughter who at 30 weeks old is around the age that countless other babies in second and third trimesters have been aborted by this heinous procedure. I am horrified that there is no state legislative ruling in place in Oregon that prosecutes abortionists who perform partial birth abortions in Oregon. Perhaps further clarity about what this abortion procedure actually entails is needed. During partial birth abortion, a baby who at this point in pregnancy is viable, as babies as young as 21 weeks are now surviving with medical support, is delivered feet first, which is dangerous for the mother, until just the head remains inside the birth canal. The abortionist then uses forceps.
I'm going to stop that. We don't need that kind of description.
All right.
But if you have further testimony,
I do.
That would
Thank
be
you.
Fine.
This procedure is not safe for women, nor is it ever medically necessary. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists said that a select panel could identify no circumstances under which this procedure would be the only option to save the life or preserve the health of the mother, end quote. Then President of the American Medical Association, Dr. Daniel Johnson, said to the New York Times, quote, "The partial delivery of a living fetus for the purpose of killing it outside the womb is ethically offensive to most Americans and physicians. Our panel could not find any identified circumstance in which the procedure was the only safe, effective abortion method. The ban is not inconsistent with Roe v. Wade. No procedure necessary to preserve the life or the health of the mother will be denied. It just won't be done in this inappropriate way," end quote. Oregon would not be alone in passing a ban to stop this procedure. Supported by the 2007 decision of the Supreme Court in Gonzales v. Carhart, which upheld states' rights to restrict abortion as well as the federal ban, 32 states have already enacted their own bans specifically on partial birth abortion. This is the accurate reflection of public opinion as well. Gallup found that 64% of Americans support banning partial birth abortion. What women in Oregon truly need is not another excessive, unnecessary resolution. What women in Oregon need is protection from this proven dangerous procedure that partial birth abortion is. What women in Oregon, like my daughter, need is protection from this gruesome and inhumane practice. Thank you for your valuable time and consideration.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and representatives. My name is Kaylee Mosier, and I'm here to speak against HCR 6. Oregon is the only state in America that has no limits on abortion, and as such is extreme. I'm here to address a procedure called sex-selective abortion. This occurs when a parent decides to terminate a pregnancy based on the sex of the unborn child. The Economist explains, quote, "Sex selection abortion was once thought confined to certain parts of Asia, but it has spread to other continents and is now practiced here in the United States. Countries that have been practicing this method for many years, like China, are already suffering the results. The natural sex ratio averages 105 boys born for every 100 girls. In 2010, China was already seen with an inflated ratio of 123 boys for every 100 girls. Picture this, a joyous crowd gathered for a celebration. A young man dressed to the nines stands at the front, awaiting his bride. He holds his breath, waiting. She never comes. Discover magazine disclosed that, quote, "A study has found that there are currently 32 million more boys than girls under the age of 20 in China. This means that at best, 32 million Chinese men will be without Chinese brides their age. The Red State reported that in a 2011 study, 89% of U.S. Asian Indian participants chose abortion when they found out they were carrying baby girls. What are Americans communicating to females? We are telling our little girls that they are not worth as much as little boys. We are telling our little girls that life is a privilege that only some deserve. We are telling our little girls that they are less than a one-of-a-kind masterpiece. In a country that has worked so hard for gender equality, it is tragic to think we might support a method that is chipping away at the female population." The New York Times released an article that stated in regard to China, sex-selective abortion accounts for almost all the excess males. This kind of abortion became prominent in China when ultrasound and abortion technology became more available to the public, something already occurring in America. Sex-selective abortion defies the American promise of equality and defies the value of human life. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We have the power to protect American rights. We have the power to ensure American rights are enjoyed by every human being. We have the power to end gender discrimination in the womb. And yet the question hangs in the air above us. Will we? I ask you to vote no on HCR 6 and instead to adopt a ban on sex selection in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Moshe. Thank you both for coming. We'll hear now from Becky Strauss and Jeff Barker. Is Jeff here?
No, I don't see him.
Another committee.
Yeah, he's supposed to be
in there.
Happy birthday, Mr.
Thank you, Madam Chairman of the Committee. I'm Representative Jeff Barker, for the record, from House District 28. And as I'm dressed up, as most of you know, I'm celebrating my 70th birthday today, so I might point out that I was 30 years old when Roe versus Wade passed. I remember pre-Roe versus Wade days. I had a very good friend who pre-Roe versus Wade had an unwanted pregnancy. She was down in California, went down to Mexico to see a doctor to get an abortion, which was legal down there at the time. The doctor butchered her. It was an unsafe abortion, and it was with tragic results. The last time I talked to her, she didn't think she'd be able to have children. Many demonstrable health benefits, physical, emotional, and social, have accrued to Americans since 1973, when the U.S. Supreme Court legalized abortion in Roe versus Wade. Today, as we mark the 40th anniversary of this landmark decision, it's important to remember how far Roe has brought us as a society and the many benefits that resulted from legalization of abortion. In 2011 alone, 24 states enacted 92 laws restricting access to safe, legal abortion, shattering the previous record of 34 abortion restrictions adopted in 2005. In sum, no amount of controversy over abortion can negate the evidence that American women, men, children, and families have reaped great benefits to their physical, mental, and social health from the U.S. Supreme Court's historic decision in Roe versus Wade. Any erosion of a woman's right to access to a medically safe, legal abortion jeopardizes the health of women, their families, and the nation as a whole. House Concurrent Resolution 6 is necessary to reaffirm that a woman's personal medical decision-making about pregnancy is a fundamental right in the state of Oregon. 2013 marks the 40th anniversary of Roe versus Wade, and the legislature can take this opportunity to reaffirm that abortion should remain a safe and legal medical procedure without unnecessary government interference. Decisions about whether to choose adoption end a pregnancy or parent a child must be left to the woman, her family, her faith, in consultation with her doctor or health care provider. HCR 6 also reaffirms that every woman deserves professional, non-judgmental, and fully confidential health care, regardless of where she lives, as well as access to all methods of birth control approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Good afternoon, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. My name is Becky Strauss. I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to come before you today in support of HCR 6. Just am here to provide our perspective on this issue. Since its founding, the national ACLU and our affiliates nationwide have recognized that personal privacy and reproductive rights are among our most important constitutional liberties. So much depends on that ability to decide, free from government interference, whether and when to become a parent. With reproductive freedom comes very important choices, the opportunity to obtain a good education, the opportunity to shape one's economic circumstances, to participate in the democratic process, to build families, and so on, and so on. At the time that the National ACLU first opened its doors back in 1920, most states criminalized birth control and abortion care, and it was a federal crime to distribute birth control information through the U.S. mail. Yet many women, as we know and has been discussed already, still sought birth control and still sought abortions. The criminal ban on abortion in most states, as I referenced, that began in the mid-1800s and lasted until the Roe v. Wade decision in 1973, affected low-income women the most profoundly. And I'll note that, in 1969, the ACLU of Oregon helped to lead the fight to legalize abortion here in Oregon with the successful passage of Senate Bill 193. So that happened just a few years ahead of Roe v. Wade. And so 40 years later, after kind of at the 40th anniversary of Roe v. Wade. We do remain steadfastly committed to these rights and to this work, and we are an active member of Oregon's coalition to ensure that women's rights are protected. In Roe v. Wade, the U.S. Supreme Court affirmed that the constitutionally protected right to privacy does include a woman's ability to make her own personal medical decisions without the interference of government. We believe that every person should be able to make informed, meaningful decisions about reproduction free from intrusion by the government. HCR 6 would affirm that commitment in Oregon to these fundamental rights and protections, and for that we ask for your support. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming to speak to us today.
Thank
now
you.
We have Deborah Tiden.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
It's actually Tilden.
Tilden.
Deborah Tilden.
Sorry, there was no L put in there.
Good afternoon. Dear Madam Chairwoman Tomei, Vice Chairman Olson, he has stepped out, and Gomberg, and fellow committee members, staff, and guests. Thank you all for being here today. Quite honestly, I don't fully understand why this hearing is taking place, and so much energy and resources are being allocated for this because Oregon has no restrictions on abortion at this time. For the record, I personally experienced an abortion here in Oregon at the Lovejoy Clinic in Portland at the young, very scared, and vulnerable age of 18 years old. And also being a spokeswoman for countless women who have also experienced the soul wound of abortion and the trauma. As a regional coordinator for the Silent No More Awareness Campaign and Abortion Recovery International, since going through my own personal healing and recovery process in 2003, after suffering in silence for 23 years, I was astounded by how many other women were experiencing and had experienced the same things after their abortions. Things such as alcohol and drug abuse that had not been part of their life prior to that experience. It became a way to numb the pain in my heart and the thoughts that ran away in my mind. Recurrent nightmares for more than 23 years for me until I went through my healing process. Intense relationship and marriage issues. Many had repeat divorces. Bouts of depression, deep sadness, and confusion on the anniversary dates and seasons of my abortion and those women's stories, and at the time of when my child would have been born, which was around Mother's Day. Mother's Day brought so much emotional confusion, which increased later as my other three children came along. The mixed emotions grew stronger. Little did I know at the time that there was a name for this called disenfranchised grief. Noted PhDs Teresa Burke and David Reardon in Forbidden Grief, The Hidden Pain of Abortion, a must read for all who want to optimally serve, care for, protect, and defend women, and better understand reproductive grief and loss, including abortion's impact on our lives. I also experienced eating disorders. For me, it was binge eating. Again, these are things I never experienced prior to my abortion. Over the last 10 years, I have tried to understand the bigger picture. Quite honestly, it has become very disheartening that women are not better informed of all of the risk factors of abortion, which we are sold as no big deal. Women deserve better because it is a very big deal. The worldwide evidence is growing. Let me list a few. Each one is fully referenced in the packet that we provided today. In some cases, I've included the full report and articles. The breast cancer epidemic, modeling the forecast based on abortion and other risk factors, the Journal of American Physicians and Surgeons, fall 2007. Finland's epidemiological study, published in the European Journal of Public Health in 2005, conducted by Finland's National Research and Development Center for Welfare and Health. stakes. The researchers looked at data between 1987 to 2000 on all deaths among women of reproductive age, age 15 to 49. The suicide rate among women who had abortions was six times higher than that of women who had given birth in the prior year and double that of women who had miscarriages. Britain's Royal College of Psychiatrists issued a statement in the Sunday Times, March 16, 2008. Royal College warns abortions can lead to mental illness. They urge the government to undertake a full review of the linkages between abortion and women's mental health. The statement reflected a growing body of evidence, including a long-term study out of New Zealand published in 2006, that abortion is in fact linked with elevated levels of mental distress, including depression, substance abuse, and suicide in young women. A New York Times article titled Russia enacts law opposing abortion, requiring abortion providers to devote 10% of any advertising to describing the dangers of abortion to a woman's health, and they make it illegal to describe abortion as a safe medical procedure. The British Journal of Psychiatry, Abortion and Mental Health, Quantitative Synthesis and Analysis of Research, 1995 to 2009, Obstetrical and Gynecological Survey, review article, Long-Term Physical and Psychological Health Consequences of Induced Abortion, review of the evidence. And I've also included a 16-page research and key facts report, Abortion's Harm to Women, published studies, significant risk of injury and death from abortion. Like I said earlier, I am astounded why women are not given all of the risk factors. I wish I had been. My question to you is, why aren't we here affirming a woman's right to know the truth of all of the risk factors of abortion? Reproductive grief and loss, risk factors that could profoundly impact her life and health, relationships, marriage, and family. Why aren't we here asking ourselves why we are not pursuing more unbiased, peer-reviewed, double-blind research studies as other countries have? Abortion is a heart issue. Abortion trauma is wounding to the soul that cuts to the core of a woman's being. To end the life of your own child growing inside is profoundly impacting. Don't our precious sisters of humanity deserve better than this? Every woman I have personally met and or worked with over the last 10 years in post-abortion healing and recovery who chose an abortion in the second term of pregnancy or later have been unable to have children due to complications despite legal safe abortions after 1973. These are facts and real life stories of real women who were lied to and sold a bill of goods that their abortions were no big deal. They were reassured, you can have lots of children later when you are more ready. Do you realize the depths of grief, depression, and relationship difficulties that these women have had to endure based on the lies they believed about safe and legal abortions? In closing, I have so often tried to run from this work. It's heart-wrenching to hear the real-life stories surrounding women, young and old. More than half of them that I have worked with were not given a choice. They were pressured, forced, coerced, manipulated, and sadly, in some cases, their very lives were threatened without the protection of the abortion clinics. How does this affirm a woman's choice? So I ask you, no, I beg you, to rethink and go back to the drawing board and don't just take my word for it. Do the research, dig deep, and really search your own hearts. Let's find ways how we can really help women. My only regret in this life is that I robbed my own children, our family, this world, and this mama's heart the opportunity to love and be loved by my child, whose life was ended because of the lie of abortion. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for coming, Ms. Tilden.
With that committee, we are going to be closing the informational hearing on HCR 6. And we do have written testimony that's been passed out. And there are probably emails also. And with that, we will close the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. Thank you very much. See you Wednesday.
So I was just curious if the stickers out.